ability to explore our world in ways you've never imagined, you can have that opportunity. As we grow and expand, new features will be added, allowing you to experience radio programming at a fresh new level. I invite you to join me, November Hansen, host of Voice of the People. Together, we can expand our horizons and peer into multifaceted possibilities. This program will broadcast live Saturday evenings on the Paranormal Radio Network.
A radio program that looks at the UFO topic from a fresh perspective. Sound interesting? Then join us here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network every Friday evening at 11 p.m. Eastern, 10 p.m. Central for The Joyner Report, hosted by journalist and researcher Angela Joyner. Are you interested in a radio program that focuses on the deeper aspects of the UFO topic? Would you like to explore the facts and truths of what ufology and UFO research are all about? Then, join us here every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, with your host, D. Andrew. Good evening and welcome to this week's worldwide broadcast of The Joyner Report. Now here's your host, Angela Joyner.
Well, hello, and welcome to the Joyner Report on WPRN-FM New Orleans and at ParanormalRadioNetwork.com. I am your host, Angela Joyner. And before we get into tonight's interviews, I'd like to update you on a couple of things. I know some of you have been following the Archer City Lights in Texas reported last month. And I want to let you know that those turned out to be a camera anomaly. Here is the report from my friend Tonio Cousin in France. And after analysis, Tonio says, these light anomalies are very likely created by unusual occurrences of several factors. A single strand of cobweb that was standing in front of the camera. And number two, the position where the IRA game spy camera was hidden in the middle of several bushes where it's easy for spiders to weave their webs. And I should note we had an investigator go to the site to examine the area and the camera, as well as download the entire card full of photos and take pictures of the camera and area as well as measurements. A temperature inversion, this is from Tonio, in the Archer City area at 5 a.m. on the day the photographs were taken, created a condensation effect on a spider web. Some wind made the spider web move randomly, he says. So probably a right distance between the spider's web and the camera IR flash that allowed the light to be diffracted on the tiny water droplets on the spider's web, and then it was returned just right on the CCD sensor. The LED lights were in rows of 14, and the lights in the picture, number 14. Tonio says he knows of similar previous stories that occurred in Alto, Texas at the beginning of 2009, and in Alabama also in early 2009, and in Illinois in 2007. And this was reported on by Linda Howe at earthfiles.com, he says. So, Tonio said he didn't agree with MUFON's analysis that the shutter remained open. And this is a quote. I respectfully disagree with his statement as, if that was the case, we should clearly see much more motion blur on the moving deer and on the branches that were moving with the wind. But the motion blur that we can see on the deer is consistent with a 1/6 shutter speed as defined in the EXIF data. Images taken with a low shutter speed invoke a visual sense of movement. And you can find the analysis of Tonio's work on Open Minds Forum. I have talked with Lisa, and you may have heard her on my show a couple of weeks ago, and I think she's okay with this. She wasn't real happy about MUFON putting this forth as a shutter coincidence to the news media, but well, not that she wasn't happy with that, but nobody talked to her about it, so she didn't really know what was going on. And I sent her Tonio's analysis, and there were some other people involved with Tonio's analysis, and I sent her all of that, and she seemed okay with that. So all she said that she ever really wanted to know was, what is the truth? And now she knows. And so here's another interesting tidbit that really took me by surprise. Well, it may only interest the locals, the ones in my area, but here we go. There was a story in the Billingham Herald written by Jeff McClain on September 8, 2010. Jeff used a UFO spin and Stephenville's notoriety as the cowboy capital of the world to write his story. And I'll just let you figure out why. But Kevin Cobb is a former Stephenville High School football player who some think made it big by playing for the Philadelphia Eagles. And he said in this story, when questioned about the Stephenville UFO, from Stephenville, Cobb said recently. And then they interview a small dairy farmer, and he's swearing to God that he saw it. And you're like, oh, man, this is going to get hairy. Well, Mike Copeland is not a hillbilly. And I would like to add here, indeed he's not. He was my high school history teacher and is a well-respected member of the community. The story continues with Cobb's high school coach for the players' last 3 years at Stephenville High. The 63-year-old is as matter-of-fact as his left arm. Born with half a limb, Copeland was never one for I can't do it, as he says. He earned a college scholarship in baseball and shoots in the 80s in golf to this day. He said he saw the UFOs. I'm embarrassed to even say it. Now, this is a quote from Mike Copeland. I'm embarrassed to even say it, but I saw something, said Copeland, as he scratches his neck with the nub of his left arm as if the hand were there. Also, I should say that I haven't tried to contact Mike Copeland. He was my high school history teacher, and this only came up on September the 8th. I don't know if I'm going to contact him. I mean, we already have a lot of witnesses for the Stephenville area. I might contact him because he's very credible and everybody in the area knows him. But I really haven't decided what I'm going to do about that. But here's another little tidbit. Last weekend, Grant and my husband Randall and Grant Cameron, I think most of you know, that Grant has the Presidential UFO website. We're attending a friend's reunion over Labor Day weekend, and the most bizarre story was brought to our attention. And, you know, it just seems like, guys, wherever I go, now that I'm involved in this, there's something that comes up about it. And I don't really know how to explain that, but it just seems that it's something that's following me, or I'm following it, I don't know. But here you go. I've had a friend since childhood, and he told me of an experience that he had in 1967 in Stephenville. He was a child taking out the family garbage. And he must not have been more than about 7, 8 years old. So he said when he took out the garbage, he noticed a blue light that enveloped him from above. And he said he looked up to see where it was coming from, and apparently it was coming from some type of craft. He went back inside his home, not thinking that much of it, I mean, he's just a little kid, so I can understand that. But he said he did remember that the grass in this place where the blue light appeared was circular, and it grew year-round. And he remembers his mom griping at his dad in the wintertime to go out and mow the patch of grass that was still growing. So all the grass around this place where the blue light enveloped him was dead, except in this place, and it was still growing. Now, his wife said it took him about 7 years to tell her about this coincidence, about the story, whatever. But once she learned of the story, he explained a lot to her about how fast her husband could heal. He's had a broken arm that the doctor said the bones growing back in the manner that they did could only be attributed to a 10-year-old. And he was well above a 10-year-old. And so Grant and I are talking about this, Grant Cameron, we're talking about this, and while we're watching him, he goes to a cooker, and we see him, he's injured by a splinter from cooking with wood. And it's a splinter in his finger, and it bled. So a few hours later, I looked at the wound that he had again, and I even tried to pull the area apart in his finger to make it open up again, but I couldn't. My husband, Randall, and Grant Cameron witnesses, it does appear he is extremely fast healing. His wife related to Grant that he had been very nervous about attending the function because I was going to be there. And I thought, how could this be? How could anyone be afraid of me? Because I'm pretty easygoing. I don't have an agenda. But then upon reflection, I knew he wasn't afraid of me. He was just afraid of telling the story and being lapped over into the field of kookdom. So his wife said Christmas 2 years ago they were in Stephenville and stopped by his old home place just so he could peer over the fence to see if the grass was still growing, and it was not. The grass was dead. Whatever had happened there, it was over. It wasn't growing. So that's just one another tidbit for you. But I want to talk about something else. And this also may only be of importance to locals. Kevin Cobb, who was a former Stephenville High School football player, who now plays for the Philadelphia Eagles, was quoted in a newspaper in Philadelphia recently. And I don't know how to put this. Okay, well, you know, Kevin's been gone for a while. He might not know the story of the Stephenville sightings. I would give him that. But, Kevin Cobb may think his hometown people are hillbillies, but I don't. I take offense to his statement. It's obvious from his statement that he doesn't really know the scope of the story. Not that it will matter, because Stephenville is Friday Night Lights when you get down to it. And I think you all know the movie about Friday Night Lights in Odessa, Texas. So, Kevin quoted basically paraphrased, he said there was a dairy farmer that said this was what happened, and it was, oh my God, this is going to get hairy. Well, then you have his coach, Mike Copeland, coming forth saying, I saw something too. I don't know what it was. I'm almost embarrassed to talk about it, but there you go. So, you know, it just goes to show that so many people are hesitant or fearful of talking about this phenomena because you might be labeled a kook. Oh, my God. Yes, that's true. You might be labeled a kook. So this writer, Jeff, he put the spin on the story about UFOs and the Stephenville area being known as the cowboy capital of the world, and I'll let you figure out why he did that. But in other matters, I would like to report that Grant Cameron, my husband Randall, and I made a quick trip to San Antonio to investigate the Weinbrenner story we told you about last show. We have completed our article, and we are shopping the article around just to see who might want to pick it up. This is my very first visit to a national cemetery, and I enjoyed it very much, and I learned a lot. Grant stayed with us for 2 weeks, and we got quite a bit done for the book, Presidents and UFOs, and I look forward to Grant's return, hopefully in November. So we'll see how that goes. Okay, so on with tonight's show. Tonight's guests are Alejandro Rojas and Antonio Junez. Alejandro is a radio host for Open Minds Radio, a part of Open Minds Productions, where he is also a writer and research specialist. Open Minds focuses on UFO-related phenomena. For several years, Alejandro was the official spokesperson for the Mutual UFO Network as the director of public education. He has been a UFO paranormal researcher and journalist for nearly a decade, and has spent many hours in the field investigating the phenomenon. He's also been interviewed by media organizations around the world, including the largest cable and network news agencies, with several appearances on Coast to Coast AM. Antonio is a reporter for Open Minds and has covered the UFO field from an international perspective for more than 30 years. His articles have appeared in dozens of publications in the U.S., Latin America, Europe, and Japan. He was also the co-author of the Lawrence Rockefeller-funded UFO briefing document, The Best Available Evidence, and edited the book, A Study Guide to UFOs, Psychic and Paranormal Phenomena in the USSR. Antonio studied journalism at the University of Chile in Santiago in the 1970s. He has lectured at dozens of UFO conferences all over the world, and he's been interviewed by many media outlets, including the Washington Post, the Sci-Fi and History Channels, etc. He received the Ufologist of the Year Award at the National UFO Conference in Miami Beach in 1990, and the Courage in Journalism Award at the X Conference in Gaithersburg, Maryland in 2007. I first met Antonio when he interviewed me at the XCon in 2008. And I first met Alejandro during the Stephenville story when we were interviewed at the same time on several different radio shows. All right. Welcome, guys. I'm glad to have you on the Joyner Report.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, my pleasure, Angela.
All right. You know, you guys mean a lot to me. You've been with me since the beginning. And I mean since the Stephenville stories in 2008. But let's talk about this first half of tonight's show. I would like to remember Wendell Stevens, who died earlier this week after researching the UFO phenomena for the better part of 60 years. I had the pleasure of sharing a cab ride to the airport from Eureka Springs after the Ozark conference in 2008. And I hate to say this, I really do. I didn't really know who was in my company at the time, and we were both exhausted, so I missed my chance there. Alejandro, I know you were close to Wendell, so why don't you fill our listening audience in on who Wendell Stevens was?
Yeah, Yeah, both of, well, of course, Antonio's been working with him with the 3 or 4 or 5 decades he's been in this field. But Wendell was one of the first. I mean, he was in the Air Force during Blue Book, and he says, you know, some of his reports got into Blue Book. He was able to see all of what happened back then. And he has been someone who has been collecting reports and information all the way back then. So he's amassed this incredible collection. In fact, you know, one of the things, many things he was known for was his UFO photo archive, because he's collected photos over these decades. And that's probably, in my eyes, the most impressive thing about his collection of data that he has gotten. These impressive UFO photos and stories from around the world. You know, we've really taken advantage of especially some of the research, the cooperation he did with Chinese researchers, and some of the stories and pictures and illustrations they've done. And we've done 2 stories in our magazine on that. One of them written by Wendell and his history with the Chinese ufologist, and then another one, which actually people will, the subscribers, those lucky listeners who are subscribers to our magazine, will be getting their new magazine real soon here. And there's a story about the Norway spirals, and we found a bunch of illustrations and reports in China on spirals. So lucky for us, you know, Wendell had this information. So he also, his big focus was contactees. He was one of the first Billy Meyer, English-speaking Billy Meyer researchers, and brought that to the world, helped with getting pictures out to the public and information about Billy Meyer, which, of course, is highly, highly, highly controversial. And even though it's controversial and people get really emotional around the Billy Meyer case, you know, Wendell's always been, to the end, such a nice and pleasant person who has never spoken bad about anybody. No matter if he disagrees with someone or not, I personally, in the many conversations I had, he used to hang out here up until, unfortunately, his passing a lot. And we got to spend a lot of time with him, especially out here. And then I spent time with him before. But I've never heard him talk bad about anybody, which is really nice and refreshing. As you know, now being in this field, sometimes, well, not everybody's like that. But
right.
There are many other contact cases that he covered, many of which have kind of been gone by the wayside, where people have forgotten about them. And it's something that hopefully people kind of revisit, some of those cases that he's studied.
Antonio, what do you remember about Wendell? What can you tell us?
Yeah, well, I'm, you know, since his unfortunate passing away, of course, he was quite, you know, he was 87 years old and had been ill lately. But I was trying to remember when I first met him, and I cannot pin it down, you know. I know it was probably sometimes in the 1980s. I knew his name even before that. I began my career as a UFO journalist in the late 70s, and when there were several newsstand magazines. And I remember seeing his articles back then, so it was probably some of the very first articles I ever read on the subject were by Wendell. A lot of them had to do with these photo cases that he became so famous for. And then, of course, you know, the contactee and the Billy Meyer story. I think that it was sometime in the 80s, probably mid or late 80s, and I saw him in many, many conferences around the world. Wendell was very famous, not just in America, but internationally. I remember flying with him and with many other speakers to Frankfurt, Germany, at a very large conference called Dialogue with the Universe in Frankfurt, organized by Michael Heseman in 1989. I remember sitting next to him on the long flight to Europe, and and so and having the opportunity to chat with him. He was a very pleasant man, and even though, you know, some of his cases were a little bit on the wild side, I can say that I agreed with all his conclusions, but like Alejandro said, you know, he was a very kind and pleasant fellow. Of course, I remember seeing him many times in the 90s in the Ozarks Conference, which I used to go a lot, and he was always there. That's where you met him. And then there was a period where I didn't see him, which would have been the earlier part of this decade. But then, of course, when I came to work for Open Minds in the Phoenix area, we would see him all the time. In fact, I remember when I flew in July of last year for my job interview with, you know, at this company to see if they would hire me, which they fortunately did. I remember that day, I was only coming for one day. I was living in Northern Virginia in the Washington, D.C. area, which is when we met, I remember, at the X conference. And it so happened that Wendell came with his wife Susie on a big truck, and he was bringing his collection. As you know, as we've put it in our website, Open Minds acquired the Wendell Stevens archives, including his library, his periodicals, his correspondence, and probably the most in video collection, but then the most important part of it, his entire photo archives. So, and he was very happy. I know that he told Jim DeLatoso, who was a very close friend of Wendell, had been associated with him for years, had worked together on the Billy Meyer case and many other. Jim was basically the photo analyst for a lot of the cases they worked together. And one of the things that it was Jim, in fact, who called us this Tuesday, you know, with the sad news that Wendell had just passed, and telling us that one of the things that Wendell was very happy is that his entire legacy, in other words, his life's work, was preserved, and it was going to be, was in good hands. And also, I think I had the honor of doing probably what is the last interview with Wendell. He used to come here very often, and we knew that he was in not in good health. That, I mean, you never know when people are going to die, but we were hoping that he would be at least around till the, you know, the big International UFO Congress, which we'll have in Fort McDowell later in February. But I guess it wasn't meant to be. But we knew that it was. We had to try to get as many information from him as we could while he was still in shape to give it. And so we interviewed him. We have a studio here in Open Minds, and I conducted what is most likely the last interview with him. That was in late July, and I'm sure we will be using. We'll transcribe it and publish it in the magazine or in the website. Or in any other medium, you know. So, yeah, I'm saddened, but at least I'm happy that in this last year that I've been working for Open Minds, I had the opportunity to spend a lot of time with him, and he will certainly be missed.
Well, he will be missed, and I looked at the video you guys had on today on Open Minds of kind of sort of like a tribute, a memorial to Wendell.
A memorial, yes.
Yes, and I thought it was very impressive. I thought it was very good. And you could see that how in the last 2 years he's had sort of gone down.
Oh, yeah. But, yeah. I mean, you can have three interviews there, or four even, and, you know, that we've done just the last few months. And from the last one to the one just prior to that, you can see a huge difference in weight loss. And everything. So that's what.
Yeah, he looked very different.
Uh-oh. But his mind was still there at the end. You know, he was still able to speak, and he's very energetic and coming out. He was really excited that his files were being, because we spend a lot of time. This has been Wendell week, so we've got a lot of Wendell stuff up on our website this week, and memorial for him. But we also, you know, regularly put up stories that his pictures, all pretty soon we'll have pretty much everything we have in his archives practically up on the web or in our magazine, because we've been using a lot of it, and getting it out to the public, and he was really excited about that. And it's an honor to be able to do that for him.
Well, of course, it is an honor, but I think we should mention here, and you guys might not want to do this, and if you don't want to, fine. But I don't think he donated them. I think John Rayo, owner of Open Minds Productions, paid for his library and his periodicals and his DVDs and his books. Is that right?
Yeah, that is correct. There was a payment. Part of it was done also in the form, like he was a consultant for us. But even though that arrangement was done before my time, but yes, it was not just like a donation. You're right on that. But I want to add something that even though it's not ufologically related, I think you as a Texan will get a kick out of it. And I used to enjoy talking with Wendell, not just on his anecdotes about UFOs, but other things about his life, because he had such an interesting life. For instance, he was an Air Force attaché in Bolivia, and he used to tell me stories about his adventures in South America. But then one day he told us a story that after he retired from the Air Force, he was working for an aviation company. I think I forgot the name of it. It's in our biography. And one of the jobs is they used to fly airplanes. I'm still under contract with the Air Force, but independent, you know. It was a private company.
And he was in the Air Force.
Yeah, oh, of course. He was even before the Air Force. He joined the Army Air Corps when, you know, during World War II, before the Air Force was even created. But he went into the Air Corps, and he was in the Pacific Theater during the World War II. So he fought in the war in Japan. And then, of course, when the Air Force was created in 1947 as part of the National Security Act, which also created the CIA, you know, they reorganized the entire national security apparatus, which some people believe that maybe the UFO situation had also something to do with that. Then he was his first job was in Wright-Patterson. At that time was called Wright Field in Ohio.
Wright Field,
Project Blue Book. And he used to work next door to what was called Project Sign. So even though technically he was not part of that department, he was next door, and, you know, he knew what was going on. Then, around 1949, he went to Alaska with the Air Force, and it was part of an Arctic mapping project. It was top secret that the military were conducting.
I'm sorry, Antonio, I didn't understand you. What sort of mapping project was
it? Arctic, the Arctic region, the polar region.
Arctic mapping.
Yeah, right. Okay. And probably because, you know, the Cold War had started, and they were probably afraid that, you know, an invasion could come from the Soviet Union. And so they were flying these B-29s with special cameras and stuff to do this mapping project, and they detected a number of UFOs. And that was the beginning of his interest in the UFO phenomena, because he was a witness. He knew immediately when that was happening.
Well, tell the Texas story, though. I'm excited. This is a good story. I wanted to bring this one up, too.
Oh, yeah, so the Texas story. So then, like I said, he retires from the Air Force around 1963, and he's working for this aviation company, flying airplanes, and one time they have a malfunction in their aircraft, and they're flying over Texas, and they have to land. They have no choice, and they see an airfield there, and so they land. Guess where that was? It was Lyndon Johnson's ranch. Yes, and as soon as they landed, it wasn't even listed on the maps, you know, because nobody was supposed to land there. And as soon as they land there, they're immediately surrounded by the Secret Service, and they just grill them and, you know, take them and for debriefing and what were you doing here and so on and so forth. But eventually, you know, there was. They just had an emergency and they just landed there and so they were released. I'm looking here at the biography, the obituary that was Hamilton Aircraft.
My goodness, that's amazing.
Yeah, isn't that an amazing story? So, and he said that he was okay, but then some other guys, I guess had had one of his co-pilots had some trouble in the military, so he was really being grilled. But he, you know, Wendell was, you know,
Lyndon Johnson, Fairfield.
Okay, well, Alejandro, what do you have to say about that aspect of the story? I mean, that's pretty incredible.
Oh yeah, just that, right? Lyndon Johnson, they were in trouble. I remember him saying, and they saw the airfield and they asked to land, and they were denied. They said, "No, you can't land there." No. Wendell said, "You know what, tough, we got to land there." So we're
Yeah, we got no choice. So, you know, that he was always fun. You could always talk about, it didn't even have to be UFOs. You could, he had just great anecdotes about the many things that he had seen and done. So he was certainly one of the giant figures of ufology. You know, he received the award too at the big symposium in Brasilia in 1997 for lifetime achievement, and many other awards which we have here in the collection.
Well,
and
okay.
The most important thing is we will be posting this, you know, over time. So certainly this legacy is preserved.
Well, Antonio, what do you think? I mean, what is your personal opinion? What will Wendell Stevens be most remembered for in the field of ufology? Is it going to be his work with Billy Myers? Is it going to be...
Probably will be the work with Billy Myers, because even though people in Germany Germany, Austria, whatever, the German-speaking countries already had begun to investigate that case, it was really the team of Wendell, the elders, and then later Jim Delatoso, who really introduced the Billy Meyer case in the United States, because at that time, we're talking about the mid-70s, all the material was only published in German. So as far as people knew, it was a Swiss case, but, you know, from the German-speaking part of Switzerland, so it was virtually unknown. Probably eventually the photos might have become known, but the details, you know, the contact notes, everything, and it was Wendell really that was the engine behind that. But of course, that was only one thing. He was very proud of the Bill Herman case in Charleston, South Carolina. It was a very interesting contact or abduction case, more abduction case actually, because it was. The beings were gray, like type beings, and were said to be from Zeta Reticuli. So it had some similarities to the Betty Hill case. And he wrote two books about that. And
how many
other
books did he write in all? He wrote a
22.
Lot of books, right? 22. My goodness.
Yeah, of course, many of these books were co-authored. So there were only a few that he wrote 100% by himself. He had this small publishing company, and he would publish all these really far out contactee cases that no mainstream publisher would touch. Most of them actually from foreign sources, from Brazil, from all over the world. But what he would do is he would not only publish the original manuscript, but he would add a lot of material from his files. Other cases that had similar aspects and photographs and so on. So that's why these books, he became co-author of these books. But a total of 20.
Now, Alejandro, I think I saw an email from you that said you saw Wendell about 10 days before he passed away. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the last time he was here, and actually, luckily, that was the last time he was here. We also, you know, did some interviews with him, like Antonio said, on video.
And so, what do you remember about that last interview? What was most impressive to you? How did he seem to you at that time? Were you thinking 10 days before he died that, okay, this is it, this is all there is?
Well, I had, in the last 3 years, three grandparents pass. So, yeah, when I saw him He actually came quite a bit right at the end there. But when I saw him, we didn't see him for a few months. And then
Alejandro, did he drive himself to your office from Tucson?
Oh, no. His wife would drive him. But after this short period of time where we had seen him again, he was in a wheelchair and he had lost a lot of weight. So that's when I knew that that's when I was worried he might not make it to the Congress in February. But I was surprised because his mind was so much there. I was surprised that it did happen as quickly as it did. But I was here to see him and talk to him for a little bit, and then I was busy with something else when Antonio actually did that interview with him.
Okay. Did you think that Wendell, when you did that last interview, did you think that was the last one?
Well, let me clarify one thing. We saw him 10 days ago. But that was not the recorded interview. The recorded interview was on his previous visit to the office. I believe it was around July 23rd. So that's the last official recorded interview.
Okay.
Let me see.
But when you last saw him, Antonio, he was in a wheelchair.
Oh yeah, not just even the last time. The last two or three times he was in a wheelchair, and he was constantly had to, because he had a respiratory problem. So
what was his illness? His illness was age. Was that right?
Basically, I would say yes. Yeah, I don't know the medical details, but we could in the 1 year that I have worked here in the Phoenix area, in which I saw a lot of Wendell, except maybe in the winter time because he had a pneumonia, and so he stopped coming. In the summer and last fall he was coming once a week basically, and then suddenly for about 2-3 months he stopped coming. So we knew that he wasn't in very good shape. But then managed to come a few times. No, of course I didn't know that was the last interview. We knew that he definitely did not have very long to live. But, you know, you always hope. My mother, you know, she lived till 98. And when I would see her, I never knew because I had to fly to South America. I never knew if that was the last time. Then a year later, I would see her again, you know, so you never know, but you always hope that you will get to see them. So I figured that he probably had maybe 6 months or something like that, but on the other hand, I can't say that I was surprised. But his mind was sharp. It was definitely not, his mind was all there. His body was just giving up. And if you look at the memorial that our TV producer, Tom Ruffin, did, you can see, and you can see that when indicted from the last interview, and you can actually almost see how he's becoming, you know, more ill and in worse shape from one.
Well, yeah, I saw that because it looked like he had a lot of weight loss. It was very compelling.
He was very frail. Yeah.
Yes, he was very frail, and it was very sad. So. Yes. Antonio, you have followed this phenomena for many, many years.
Yeah, 33 years.
What do you think that the public or the UFO community will remember Wendell Stevens as?
How will they remember him? Well, as one of the pioneers.
How will remember him, yes.
Definitely one of the pioneers. He was one of the founding figures of American ufology. And unlike others, like Dr. Hynek or many, you know, the Major Kehoe, many of the others, you know, that founded important organizations, but they were much more conservative, ufologically speaking. Wendell really was... He didn't seem afraid at all to go into the really wild cases, contactee cases, whatever it was, you know. He wasn't guarded like many other figures. So yeah, he had the courage to go where others wouldn't. And
Antonio, do you think he'll be remembered as someone that had the courage to investigate contactees and all the stories that were a little on the wild side? I mean, he was on that level of, okay, I have an open mind, and I'm going to look into this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the history of ufology in the first two decades or even three decades, anything to do even with humanoids, anything that where you had a being, these organizations wouldn't touch it. APRO, which is the one that Wendell did become involved, they were in Tucson, the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization led by the Coral and Jim Lorenzen, which started in the late 50s and became very important in the 60s and 70s. They were more forward-thinking, and they did talk about humanoid cases and abductions, but they still wouldn't touch the contactee. MUFON wouldn't touch the contactee phenomena at all. I don't think even now they touch it. CUFOS wouldn't touch it either. So, but Wendell wasn't afraid. He just wanted to know, I guess, really what was going on. So that certainly that's one of the things that he will be remembered. And you have to also understand that he was very well known internationally. And that was not so much for the Billy Meyer case, but, well, partly because of all these manuscripts that he published, but also because of his photo collection, and which he started, I guess, during the years where he was associated with APRO. And so what happened is, and we, of course, have his periodicals collection from all over the world, as well as his library, Japan, Germany, Brazil, Argentina, Denmark, Sweden, you name it. And what would happen is when all these different UFO periodicals in books and magazines and some very obscure newsletters, they would publish his pictures. And so they would, you know, he had some kind of exchange arrangement with a lot of these publications. In some cases, maybe he got paid. In other cases, probably it was very little money. But he would send them photos and they would send them the publications. And so that's how his name became, was very famous abroad. He was one of the best known American ufologists internationally.
Well, certainly he spoke all over the world. He was very well known in the UFO, what are you going to call this? The UFO phenomena or the UFO community. He was very well known in that.
Yeah, everybody knew his name, anybody that was interested in the phenomenon. He spoke, I don't know how many languages. I know that he spoke Spanish, not perfectly, but he had been, like I said, air attaché in Bolivia for about 3 years. We have photos. Well, they're in the memorial where he's shown there with a bunch of military officers, including one guy who at the time was, I guess, a colonel or something, and people in the United States wouldn't know his name, but I, coming from Chile, you know, Bolivia, the neighboring country, I knew his name. He was General Barrientos. He was the famous president of Bolivia later in the 60s, after he, and so Wendell had worked and knew him personally.
One of my favorite stories with his international connections was how he got this book on Chinese sightings rolling, and essentially the organization CURO, Chinese UFO Research Organization, out in China, which was kind of fledgling at the time a little bit underground, a group. But anyways, they got a copy of one of Wendell's books, and they appreciated what he did, and they were happy for the copy, so they sent him a bunch of their UFO cases, hundreds. But unfortunately, they were in Chinese, and he said, well, thank you, but I can't translate these. I don't have the money. And so it was actually the China Foreign Languages Bureau in Beijing. They said, you know, essentially Curl said, well, let's see what we can do. So this China Foreign Languages Bureau, this translated it into English for him, and then they resent him these files along with these illustrations in English, and that's how he was able to print the China UFO book. And it's an example of some of the great research and documentation. Especially in China, we don't get a whole lot. Lately, we've been getting more information from China through some of their newspapers, but It's one of the great treasures in his collection.
Okay, yeah, well, I want to interrupt here. I'm sorry. But I'm getting some questions here. In the chat room, and they say that Wendell Stevens was put in jail for child molestation. Can you guys address that or not?
Well, from what I understand, and I don't have a whole lot of details, first of all, that it was, I guess it, he had possession of pictures of a 16-year-old that he was put in jail for. When he told me was that he was framed, essentially, and he had some choices in front of him, and the best choice he felt he had, unfortunately, was to choose pleading guilty to this thing and then getting thrown in jail for a period of time. But that's about all the information I have. I don't have a whole lot of information. I don't know if Antonio has anything more.
Antonio, do you know anything about this
child molestation
charge?
Yeah, I remember at the time in the 80s. That happened sometime in the early 80s. And he pleaded guilty, and he served 3 years. And it was pictures of a 16-year-old. Only pictures, as far as I know.
On his computer or what?
No, those were days before computer. So I guess it was done with photo camera.
Okay, and, so he pleaded guilty to possessing pornographic pictures of a 16-year-old woman.
Yes.
And that's all
he,
you know?
He knew her. He knew her. I guess he was a friend of the family or something like that. It was someone that he knew. She was 16, and he took some pictures of her nude, I guess. And I don't know the details, how he was, whether he was denounced or whatever, and he did plead guilty, and he served 3 years. So
So what does this have to do with his ufology history, anything?
Nothing. Except there's one little kind of interesting detail, and because, of course, many of the people that liked him or whatever, you know, said, well, you know, he must have been framed to silence him or something. But on the other hand, he was, I think, on a kind of a minimum security prison because he was a colonel and all that. And he actually was writing some of his first books. So, I mean, the incident itself had nothing to do with ufology, but he used that time to compile and write some of his first books. And then
there is a question here in the chat room, and they say, he took the pictures and knew she was so young. Do you have any, that's the question there. I don't know.
I don't know the details. I mean, other than what we just told you, that's all I know. Oh, yeah, I believe he took the pictures himself, yes. But I'm not even sure of that.
Stuff. Well,
yeah.
You know,
he told me told me he was innocent of and didn't take them, but that's all I know. So.
Say that.
Yeah, I'm only saying what I heard at the time. This was long before I knew him. I met him in the late 80s. Maybe it was at the 19. If memory serves me, I think I met him for the first time at the MUFON Symposium in American University, where he wasn't a speaker or anything, in 1987. In fact, he had been kind of ostracized because of this episode. And I believe that he showed up at the 87 symposium, so that he was definitely out of prison. He was for 3 years, as far as I remember.
Alejandro, what did he tell you? He thought he was set up. What did you say? We didn't catch that.
Oh, yeah, just that he was innocent, that he hadn't done what he was charged for, and that he was set up for it, is what he told me. I wasn't, even though we're journalists and perhaps we should have pursued that, I just didn't have the gall, I guess, to really question him thoroughly on that chapter of his life, although I had been interested and I was curious of the details. And he had volunteered that just in conversation at one time where he was just telling stories, and then he told me about that. But I really didn't pursue it. And, you know, normally I don't mind asking hard questions. I know you're not afraid of that, which is wonderful. That's why I think you have a great show. But he was just such a kind person. And, of course, he's definitely elderly and an older gentleman by this point. But he was just such a kind person. It's difficult. And when you look at his pictures, and lots of people have been saying that this week, with all these pictures that we've been posting throughout his life, you know, you just see in his face this kindness. And, you know, at least
all right,
when
and
I've known him.
Was that Alejandro? We're at the top
yes.
of the hour. We're at 10 o'clock, so we're going to take a 10-minute break. I'm sorry to cut you off. I really am, because I know this is something that is important to you. But we're going to take a 10-minute break now, and we will be back with the second half of the Joyner Report.
Into multifaceted possibilities. This program Saturday evenings on the Paranormal Radio Network.
A radio program that looks at the UFO topic from a fresh perspective. Sound interesting? Then join us here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network every Friday evening at 11 p.m. Eastern, 10 p.m. Central for The Joyner Report, hosted by journalist and researcher Angela Joyner. Are you interested in a radio program that focuses on the deeper aspects of the UFO topic? Would you like to explore the facts and truths of what ufology and UFO research are all about? Then, join us here every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, with your host, D. Andrew. Good evening and welcome to this week's worldwide broadcast of The Joyner Report. Now here's your host, Angela Joyner.
Yes, I am your host, Angela Joyner, on The Joyner Report, and I am talking with Alejandro Rojas and Antonio Huneas, who actually were very good friends of Wendell Stevens, who just passed away on Tuesday. So we've been talking about some things that Wendell did, and we've got some, I don't know how to put this, some uncomfortable questions coming up in the chat room. And the chat room is at Pal Talk, but apparently, Wendell was in jail for several years for, I don't even know what for, really. Some sort of, well, Alejandro, can you help me out? I don't know what to say.
Well, yeah, I guess just like we said before, he was in jail for, I don't know what the exact charge was actually at all, just that he felt that he was set up, and he said he did not commit the crimes he was accused of, and he spent 3 years in jail, essentially what I know.
Well, it had to do with some sort of pornography is my understanding, and it's I don't know what to say about this, really, because it's being brought up in the chat room. And does that lessen his credibility as a ufologist? I don't know. What do you think, Alejandro?
I don't think it lessens his credibility. I think, I think everybody, assuming anything happened, you know, everybody makes mistakes in their lives, but, you know, had this been for some sort of fraud, or even worse, some sort of hoax or something like that that he had perpetrated, that would be different. But as far as I know, he was always an honest person, and that's what's important in ufology, is that someone is honest. I think more than anything, you know, I can appreciate people with different varying opinions. I can certainly appreciate people who are honestly pursuing the truth and perhaps not having the same perspective as I do, or believing. That's what I think is important when you're looking at credibility issues.
Well, okay. I can understand that, Alejandro. I do certainly understand that. And I think we should just move on from this topic. I don't know what's right or wrong about it. I don't know, you know, the legalities of what happened to Wendell Stevens. I certainly don't. I don't try to pretend that I have all those ins and outs. But let's just change the subject. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Sure. Yeah, there's lots of other things to discuss, yeah.
Okay, we'll change the subject. And Alejandro, you are very into the Stan Romanek story, right?
Right.
And so, you know that I was at the Aztec New Mexico conference this last March. And
right.
I was blessed to see Stan Romanek's presentation there. And although it was a little far out, I have to admit it was a little far out, it was impressive. And I don't know how to explain this. I went to his room at the motel, and you know, this is not a big place. Aztec's not a big place. So I went to his room at the motel. It was a motel, not a hotel. And I looked at some of his photos on his laptop of children that he thought were his, and I, you know, I heard his presentation and everything, and one of the things, Alejandro, that stood out to me, and I'm new at this, and I'm the first person to say I'm new at this, but it was those Audrey recordings, the Audrey recordings that supposedly there's like this, I don't know how to explain it. Can you explain it, Alejandro?
Yeah, essentially in 2004, which was a couple years after all of this started for Stan, the gentleman who was at the time tasked with putting together a documentary and documenting what was going on with his case had received a phone call. And this phone call was from this computer-sounding British voice that said, you know, Stan is very important. We're people who are in the government who are trying to help out, and you need to know that this is real, and we don't know what the visitors are doing or why they've chosen Stan, but we think that they're going to do something soon that will make their presence apparent to the world, essentially, and that, you know, there's people in the government who don't want this to happen, so be careful because they don't want Stan's information getting out, and essentially something to that note. And also at this time, Stan was living in Colorado Springs, which is the headquarters of Air Force Space Command. There is also the Air Force training there at the Air Force Academy, Air Force Base Command is out of Peterson Air Force Base, which is at the base of Cheyenne Mountain, which is where NORAD is, and of course that's the famous mountain that's dug out, and there's this entire city.
But Alejandro, you're not really addressing, in my opinion, you're not really addressing these Audrey recordings that came on your phone.
That's what I was explaining. These recordings also had said that Stan shouldn't be living there in Colorado Springs. He should move out because, like this thing said, he was living in the lion's den. And during this time is when Stan's house kept getting broken into. He got beat up. He had cables cut and his cable and phone lines were cut on multiple times. They caught on camera one person's glove. All you can see is a hand going and cutting some cables. So then Stan got a phone call that said, we know you're the same voice, saying, we know you're stubborn, but you really need to get out of Colorado Springs. You're in the, you know, you're surrounded by the military. Then he got another phone call. This time, see, the last two were voice messages. This one, Stan actually talked to the person. And they said, Stan, you're stubborn. He says, no, I'm not. And he was kind of freaking out. He didn't know who this was and if it was a joke or anything.
Well, Alejandro, you know by this time, I know that you know by this time, that the Stan Romanek story is very controversial. And you are really one of his main claims to fame. I mean, you were with MUFON. You were a national director. So you are giving credence to his story. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I stand by, and I kind of explain this to Grant. One of the reasons I love Grant Cameron is that early on when I met him, you know, his stance was, hey, my job is to get the information out. I'm not a good old boy or going to play any of these good old boy games. If you get me information, I'm going to put it on the Internet, and I'm going to get it out because that's my job. That's what we see our job as, is to get this stuff out. And I feel the same way. And I can't, you know, I'm not going to lie. I'm going to be honest. And when it comes to Romanek, even though it's a wild, wild case, like Billy Meyer or something, you know, I experienced this stuff. I was there to investigate his abduction cases the day after they would happen. I've spent time with his family. I've been there to experience phenomena, which he could not hoax unless he had spaceships or something. I mean, I've seen UFOs with him. I've seen flashes of light throughout his morning.
Okay. Well, that's fair.
These calls.
That's fair. I think that's fair. But Antonio, do you have a view on Stan Romanek? I would like to hear from you, Antonio.
Well, unlike Alejandro, I'm not that familiar with his case. Basically, I mean, I had heard something about it. And then I met him a couple of times, mostly when he came and gave a lecture here in the Phoenix area, which was quite complete. And, I mean, he showed a lot of his videos and photos and recordings and whatnot. And that's basically it. So I have not invested. I mean, I spent a little time with him at that time, but I have not really investigated the case. I think if you ask my opinion, I mean, let me put it this way. There are some aspects of his case which are undoubtedly true. You know, especially all the early videos, because they were seen by many other people. They were on the local news reports at the time. I mean, there's no question that those, you know, he had dozens of people that saw those. Then there are some other aspects, which Alejandro goes into quite a bit of detail in our third issue of the Open Minds magazine, you know, involving the mathematical equations. And although certainly it wouldn't be impossible to hoax those, there's no way that he could have done it alone. He would have had to have an accomplice with a physicist, a PhD, someone like that. They seem to be very complex and make sense. My only reservation, or maybe not my only, but my main reservation that I have on the Romanek case is that he seems to have too much evidence, really, on every single category that it kind of makes you wonder. I mean, when it comes to implants, videos, photos of aliens, mathematical formulas, and whatever, you know, he has it all, and everything is kind of perfect. So that makes me wonder. But I you know, that's just a reservation. On the other hand, I understand that the people that have spent time with him and gone to his house have experienced all this paranormal experience, you know, have actually seen a lot of weird things happening. So I think there's something to his story. Whether all of it is true, I don't know. I have not really investigated deeply.
Well, I can certainly understand your viewpoint, Antonio. I really can. And I have had some reservations myself. But I will say this. I will say that Stan and his wife had invited me to their home on numerous occasions. And Stan was one of the speakers at the Aztecs New Mexico conference that I was at. And they said, come on up, you know, just come to our house and we'll show you what we're talking about.
Oh, yeah, they're very open. Yeah, yeah, and they always invite people. I just haven't had the opportunity. I hope maybe sometime to do it. Now, did you see anything strange while you were in their home?
Well, actually, I didn't have the funds to travel there, and I'm hoping to be able to do that soon. But this whole UFO thing is a really money-sucking thing. I mean, you add up a few plane tickets, a few hotel rooms, and you're in for a lot. So, no, I have not gone, and I wish I could, but I don't have some kind of I don't know what you call that. I don't have some kind of bankroll that allows me to do that.
I understand. I mean, I've been there myself in the old days, you know. Remember we were talking at the balcony of the Hilton Hotel in...
Yeah,
and I was kind of warning you because I had been a journalist too one time, you know, and also got sucked in into this phenomenon in a different way from you. I mean, I was not in a town that had a big UFO wave, but I got involved through different reasons, but it got me too, and you know, there's like anything in life.
Well,
you know,
it's difficult.
You got your it's difficult.
It's difficult.
Ups and downs.
So what are you supposed to do? You know, you've got all these stories that you can follow, but you have no funds to do so, and that's mine.
Yeah, it's in a way it's much easier now though, because in the old days when I started in this field, which was in the 1970s. I mean, there were not even computers. I mean, there were only like huge IBM computers or a bit. I mean, there were not even personal computers. So, you needed to do research. You had to go to the library and look at newspaper clippings on microfilm and correspond with people by letter and so on, you know. So now you can do a lot of research on the web, you know. It's certainly changed tremendously.
The funds and resource thing is really what keeps ufology down for the most part. A lot of people say, you know, and that's, I think, one of the things that gets frustrating with, you know, and it's, sounds like a derogatory term, and I don't mean it that way, but some, I guess maybe you could call armchair ufologists or some of the people who are very critical of a lot of different ufologists, is that they don't go out and do this. They don't realize that you have to spend your own money. You have to put your rep on the line. You have to put your credibility on the line. You have to put your job on the line at times. You really have to. It takes a lot to get into this field. And
I think so, too, Alejandro.
And like you said, you know, we're normal people, and we have to fund these things. I mean, I spent all my extra money on this stuff, putting on lectures, flying places, like you said.
Okay, so, Alejandro, you have extra money. Wow.
I said, when I would, but it would all go into ufology, of course. So, you know, and it became, you know, it's a compulsion whenever, you know, I'm going to have a few extra bucks on my next check. How can I spend it? Maybe I'll put on a lecture and fly in, you know, or pay Dr. Leo Sprinkle to come out to Denver or whatever to, or to buy a piece of equipment to go do investigations. And, you know, a lot of people would criticize MUFON, and that's essentially what I would tell them is these people have very little time to get out there and do some research. At least they're doing something, you know, and that's why we need more funds in this field. And hopefully, you know, some organization at some point will really start to fund the research.
Well, but MUFON had that. I mean, you must admit this, Alejandro. They had that with Bigelow's funding for the STAR team. I mean, MUFON's STAR team was...
For a short period of time, they did have that. But it was a short period of time.
Yeah, and only a few, right? I mean, it's not like every MUFON investigator was paid. I think there were only a few, right? Alejandro, you would know this better, but...
Well, and that's why it was a limited budget. It wasn't like Bigelow opened up his pocketbooks. It was a limited amount of money... could be spent, and a lot of that, as anyone knows who's ever had a business, if you pay people salaries, that's a big chunk of money right there. So a lot goes to people's salaries. In this case, only a small handful, but at least you're right. There were some funds to fly some people around, and
well,
that did happen.
Was a
and
big
there
deal. That was
What's
a big
that?
Deal. That
oh,
was,
it was right. yeah. In the world of ufology,
but you're not going to have,
said,
you know,
okay.
You don't have cases that come by all the time. I mean, it has to be something that's funded over a period of time. We did print some of the good cases that they got into in their first few magazines, and there were some interesting cases, but it really has to happen over time because, for instance, you know, at Stephenville, there weren't a lot of funds, and luckily, you know, Robert Powell and Gary Schultz came around, and they were able to spend the time to do some the best research in that case. But otherwise, you know, if Stephenville doesn't come around very long, a Phoenix Lights doesn't come around very long, a landing case doesn't come around very long. So you have to, you know, these cases.
Well, I can honestly say. I can honestly say that Bigelow has never contacted me about the Stephenville Live story, not once.
Well, unfortunately, at this point, there's no science to gather from it. And that's definitely Bigelow's main deal with getting into this field.
Excuse me, Alejandro. There is science to be gathered from it. When you look at the radar report, there's a lot of science there.
Oh, well, they have the radar report. I mean, that was shared with them.
So why isn't Bigelow interested? I don't get that. I mean, we've got...
Well, because there's not, like, there's no... A radar report demonstrates that there was an object that was there that could, for instance, go very slow or extremely fast during periods of time. That's something that they have. Otherwise... if there's no trace evidence to gather information about its propulsion, you know, which is their main interest is the science end of it, then there's not much more you can get out of that.
Okay, well, here's my question to you. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
Okay. If And we know that Bigelow has in the orbit or in the sky. Okay. Well, what does he need? I mean, because can't he get the longitude, latitude of whatever is reported? And can't he go back to those satellites and say, well, yeah, here it is. Here is the photograph. What is up with that? Do you have any idea?
Well, I don't know that he owns any satellites, especially any photography satellites. I mean, those are millions, many,
so you
many
don't think
millions
he owns
dollars.
Those kind of satellites?
No, what he owns is what he's trying to do is eventually space tourism, a hotel in space. I think that's his, you know, and he has this
satellites. We all know that he has satellites. So, you know, if
I don't know that he has satellites. No, he could maybe lease a satellite. You can buy photos from other companies. It's very, very expensive, but it's a man of his resources can probably do it, but I don't know. I think when it comes to this issue of funding, and there's been a number of people, you know, that have funded things over the years. Certainly not very few, not even near what we need. But it has to be a long-term funding. If you look at the history of scientific research on any field, medicine, astronomy, whatever. They fund things for decades before you even get results sometimes. And this is what's not happening in ufology. Sometimes there comes Lawrence Rockefeller or Bigelow or one time it was Joe Firmich, and they fund one or two projects and they last, you know, at best a year, 2 years, and then that's it. And then until the next project comes. So there's been no sustained effort. I mean, I'm talking on in the private world. And
well, okay, Antonio, are you saying, and I want to make this clear to the listeners, Antonio, are you saying that Bigelow does not have satellites in the air or in space that would give him this information? Is that what your opinion is?
As far as I know, I'm not aware that he has satellites that have those capabilities. Maybe he could, or whether he can lease or get them from somewhere else, I don't know. But I have not heard of a Bigelow aerospace satellite with photographic capabilities.
Okay.
Maybe he has, but I'm not aware of it. I forgot, Alejandro, maybe you remember, we did publish the story in the magazine, that project that he's working has a...
Right.
Yeah,
and the project he's working on is the Genesis project.
The Genesis, right. But that's not his satellite.
All right.
Actually,
so, Alejandro, okay, I'm going to interrupt here. Alejandro, are you of the same opinion that Bigelow has no satellites up to report this information?
Yes, that is what I believe.
You believe that?
Yes, because I know what he's into is what he did was purchase an inflatable design that NASA had prototype tested, and then they had ditched it, and it was to, you know, launch these craft that would inflate in space and possibly be able to cheaply create a space station. And that's what he's developed and he's got up in space. And, you know, one of the things he's done is put a bunch of things in there. You can look at his site and see pictures of, you know, different things that people gave him to launch into space. And now they're floating around in this inflatable space station thing. And that's what he's spending his money on, because he wants to build a space hotel so that people can fly up there and, you know, stay in space for a period of time.
Okay.
is pretty.
Well, that's fair. I agree with you there. Okay, so is there any? Well, I don't know how to put this, but you know there was this reported craft that was in distress in Fresno, California, or outside of Fresno, and it is supposedly being researched by MUFON. And there's been quite a few stories about this. One of them was on UFOChronicles.com by Frank Warren. So what do you think about that? I don't know. I am like, okay, maybe something crashed, maybe something didn't.
Speaking in San Leandro at the X-Fest out there, and I was invited by Ruben Uriarte, who's the section director in that area, and he is, so I called and asked him what to deal with this case, and essentially he told me, you know, it's under investigation. I'll have some information out soon, but just that they didn't have much to go off of, I guess, but that they'll have information out.
Well, so did Ruben kind of present it to you like, I don't know about this, it's not the real deal, or did he think there was something to it?
No, just that I think he didn't say for sure. He said, and I didn't push it. I know that I don't want to, you know, you don't want to risk your winter.
Right.
It's under investigation. But, you know, he didn't say right off the bat, no, this wasn't the real thing or anything. It sounds possibly that if it is an unknown, it's just that, an unknown. Which is often what happens, you know. You get credible witnesses who say they saw something and then
right.
But to say these are credible people and then this is what they saw. So, although it didn't sound like it was anything really big to him, like it was going to, there were any exciting revelations to come from it.
Well, you know, it's gone all around the internet and it's become a big story in some ways that MUFON's investigating in it. There was some kind of crash or maybe not, I don't know if you call it a crash or some kind of landing that wasn't planned, but you know, it has gone, it's made the rounds, and so how are we supposed to know what's what? I don't know about that.
Yeah, hopefully we'll hear something soon, because we're definitely waiting to hear the final word on this one also.
Okay, so you don't really have the answers for that, Alejandro.
No, we've just been following it like everyone else. It just sounds like, yeah, some people had witnessed what they thought was a triangular craft that either landed or needed some sort of repair, because they felt they saw perhaps some kind of craft being repaired, and that's about it. I know the latest from the gentleman who first investigated it was that by the time he got there, it was gone. So it sounds like we're going to be left with the testimony of witnesses in this one.
Okay. Well, and meanwhile, I'm going to change the subject. And you guys have been investigating a guy named Maurizio, and this is what Grant's telling me, Grant Cameron, that he's got some YouTube videos of some craft, and it looks pretty promising, so let's hear about that. And
oh, yeah, that's the Maurizio Ruiz case, yeah.
Okay, that is Maurizio who?
Ruiz.
Ruiz.
Yeah, he's from Texas. You
from
probably
Texas.
Heard about this
okay.
case. This is not a new case.
Well,
it's 2000.
You know, I think I might have heard about it. I'm not sure. I think his videos were from April 2008. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
And
they look pretty good to you. Do they look good to you?
Well, he was here today, as a matter of fact. He came to our office this very day, and so we interviewed him. And
well, you're not answering my question. You're not answering. Antonio,
what is your question? What is your question?
Good. Are the videos?
Oh, the videos is very good. I mean, it looks very
good.
And
there's no kind of photoshopping or anything like that.
Sure. Well, as far as we know, like I said, we just talked to him today, so I cannot give you a very detailed answer yet. But it was investigated by Jaime Maussan originally, and when the video first came out, and then it was investigated by the UNAM University in Mexico City. That's one of the biggest universities in Mexico. Because what is interesting is that there's like an electromagnetic effect in this video. So the way he tells the story is that it was early in the morning in April of 2008 in this place in the Houston area. And he goes outside. The dogs become agitated, which is common, you know, animal reactions in UFO incidents. And then he sees this object. He goes back inside the house, grabs his camera, and begins filming it. And then there's like an electromagnetic effect, and which you can see on the video, and you know, because then the image gets cut, and then it reemerges again. So certainly, this is what they investigated. These scientists at the University in Mexico did, in a study that was commissioned by Jaime Maussan, and their conclusion was that the video was genuine, that there was no tampering. That was their conclusion. Now we're going to start our own investigation on this case.
Well, okay,
and then
I understand
some
that.
Other,
and but
then he has some
understand.
Other pictures too.
Antonio, do you understand why I'm interested in this? This is Texas. Okay.
Sure.
We have a guy here in Texas. He's in Houston. He took some incredible...
Yeah, the incredibly looking. Yeah.
...video.
And also he has this is good for the case that he has quite an extensive background in law enforcement. So it doesn't make it automatically true, of course, but, you know, it helps.
Well, exactly.
About the credibility of someone.
Okay.
And he brought all his diplomas and certificates and everything. He's now retired from the... He, at one time, he was in the police department. Then he was a corrections officer and so on. And he's still volunteering on gangs and things like that.
I don't want to interrupt particularly, Antonio, but this April video, okay, in my opinion... has a lot to do with the January 2008 sighting from several Erath County witnesses. Would you not agree with that?
You mean the shape of the object is similar?
Well, I'm not saying the shape of the object is similar, but we have some kind of phenomena going on here. We have Stephenville witnesses that say, you know, they saw something that was incredible. It was going at high speeds. It shows, and actually, it showed up on radar reports. So how do you relate that? This is in April 2008,
yeah.
Right?
Well, you know, a wave. I guess you had some sort of a wave in Texas. And also, he mentioned another case, and that this was not videotaped, so it's not famous, therefore it's not in YouTube or anything. I wasn't aware of that case. And this happened, I believe, in either November or December. I forgot right now, but it was towards the end of 2008. Where he saw a triangular
shaped object. This is similar to the stuff that was reported in Belgium.
Okay. Yeah.
And it was flying slowly, and he saw it quite well. And this was more towards the evening. And then he said, then there was a second witness as well. So he's not the only witness, and he reported it to MUFON. So that is in the MUFON.
All right. Okay. So Antonio, can you tell the listeners where they can see? Do you have an address?
Well, yeah. It's all over the internet. I don't have the address immediately, but if they just Google his name, which is Mauricio, Mauricio, and then Ruiz, Ruiz, Mauricio Ruiz, UFO, they'll get it. I mean,
I just put the link in the chat, too.
Oh, good. Alejandro took care of that already. Yeah,
what did you say, Alejandro?
I put the link to the video in the chat.
Oh, good. Okay, so you have the link to the video in the chat. And I think this might be something, I don't know. I studied the Stephenville sightings for quite a long time. I don't know, what's up with this or that, but we've got some new evidence here, I think. And if you go all the way back to what I was telling you about Coach Copeland, Mike Copeland, and he said he also saw it. So, it's just an incredible thing. But, okay, this is the Joyner Report. And my guests tonight were Alejandro Rojas and Antonio Benayas. And for now, we're going to say goodbye. And just so you know, the 18th of September, I am going to South Padre. And I plan on having a very good time there. And I don't know if I'll have a Friday night show after that or not, but here we go. Thank you and good night.
It's been a while since I could